Good morning, and welcome to Voice to the Voiceless. I'm your host, Bronwyn Franklin, and we're coming to you through 313 Network Solutions. Is the company that is presenting this. Excuse me. It's a little early. It's definitely my Saturday. I haven't had some Saturdays off in a while. It's pretty rainy here where I'm at. And that's okay. You know? So, it's been a while since I shared anything around my personal journey and my personal life. Back in October, I did some talking and some sharing about something that just deeply affected my heart. I ran across a Michigan Otis, which is the offenders tracking system, and I saw the young man who had murdered my son in 2006. And I saw that he was incarcerated for shooting up a house in the Southfield area, which is a suburb outside of Detroit. It was 2001. He was getting ready to come up from parole for that. He had again got a very, very low charge and conviction, similar to what happened with my son. So take you back real quick. 2006, my son was 21 years old. He was being challenged with some mental health challenges, some schizophrenia that was untreated and wasn't diagnosed. At the time, I was myself incarcerated and I couldn't get him the help. And my family, because of stigma and a belief in the Black community, you know, that doesn't happen in our family. You know, mental illness, we're stronger than that, you know. And the thing kept coming back, well, he just must be doing drugs. But this kid had experienced a lot of trauma in his life, and I have to own it. Part of it was because of my untreated mental health and my untreated bipolar and generational trauma behavior and responses that I was passing down through my children that I had gotten from my ancestors. So he had a lot of childhood trauma. There's a whole lot of things that was occurring and had occurred in his life, even before he was born, that were affecting him. So this is a 15-year-old boy that walks up and decides he wants to, excuse the expression, fuck up the bum. And he shoots my son in the head. And four other guys, kids, 13 and 15, they run away. Public street. Witnesses could not identify him as the shooter because at the time, all they could remember is the shooter had a cast on their leg. By the time the police tracked this kid down, there was no longer a cast on his leg. So they couldn't nobody pick him out. So he wound up at 15 years old doing assault with intent to do great bodily harm, less than murder. Even though my son was dead, he did juvenile time. He did 2 years. If you go back and listen to the video, the podcast, it talks about how I forgave this kid and, you know, prayed for him and his mom because, you know, the circumstances that was going on in my life with myself, another one of my sons, and the whole incarceration issue of Black people and brown people and indigenous people, you know, and the fact that we, a lot of us are not having our mental health challenges, our mental health treated, you know, because we all, as human beings, if you have a mind, you have mental. And if you have mental, you have mental health. Just like you have a body and it's called physical health, you know, so we all have it. We all have challenges. We all have good days, bad days. We all have depression. We all have grief. We all have anger. We all sadness. And some of it goes to extremes and some of it doesn't. But we all have it. Let's get rid of the stigma. That's a bunch of crap. So anyway, I had issues that were, you know. So, and I prayed and prayed and hoped that this kid would turn his life around, that the fact of knowing that you took someone's life is something that you would live with and would make you change or do different. But to read that he had went and he didn't murder anybody, but he shot up someone's house. And it looked like it may have been a drive-by from what I could just gather on the Michigan Corrections website. So in all these years, he had not been in any other trouble, or at least he had no felony record to show. But I would think that in 15 years, he would have done something better with his life. So my feelings was hurt. I was angry. I was hurt. And at the time, I thought about reaching out, writing a letter, you know, and talking to this kid, this young man, because he's not a kid anymore. He's a grown man now. He's in his 30s. And I procrastinated and I didn't do it. So I'm pretty sure he got released. I didn't go back and I look anymore. Talked to several friends and family, you know, and then they were like, well, do you really want to do that? Because you don't want him to know where you are. You don't want to know, you don't want him to know your identity and, you know, different things. And it's not that I have a fear, spirit of fear. You know, because God didn't give me a spirit of fear. He gave me a sound mind and power. So that wasn't the fear. You know, it was the thought of this whole young generation and this I don't care attitude and, you know, no respect for the elders, you know, basically shut up old woman, you know. And so my thought was, let it be. Put it back into God's hands. So I moved on. And since that October day, had a lot of things going in my house, my life. My income property caught on fire and hasn't been repaired yet. I've been ripped off by two different individuals that was supposed to contract, that had contracted to do the work, you know. And the legal fight is just devastating. And I'm without income. Well, at least most of my income is gone. I had to take a part-time job, and now I'm looking for another part-time job because the employers here in this area, they're hiring, but they're hiring at the very low, the lowest wage, the minimum amount of hours that they can give you. you know, with the most amount of work that you can, that they can put on you. No, not happening. So anyway, long story short, the anniversary rolled around to the actual murder, which all of that kind of came up probably within 30 to 60 days of his supposed release. Because he was supposed to be released sometime in February. And the anniversary to my son's murder was March the 3rd. He was shot March the 28th. He was on life support for 3 days. 2 days. Till they could harvest the organs to do the transplants. And then that's something else I keep procrastinating on. I keep procrastinating on putting together some paperwork, some letters, you know, to go out to see if I can meet or talk with the actual recipients of the donated organs at the time. And that was, now it's been 16 years. At the time, one was a 12-year-old girl. And another donor, as I was cleaning out my dad's house and paperwork, I found where one donor had written us. He was a man in his 30s then who had diabetes, and he received a kidney and pancreas. And he was so grateful because he was like, he was going to be able to spend time with his children. You know, he was going to be able to watch his 3 children grow up. He was so grateful. So that brings me fast forward. So I went to the cemetery and I cried my eyes out on the 30th of March. And I stood there in the rain and I cried and I cried and I cried. And a couple of days ago, on July the 14th, my son would have turned 38 years old. So he's been dead 17 years. And, you know, over the last couple of months, me and my oldest son, his brother, you know, and he said it to me again yesterday. He said, I really miss him a lot. We asked the questions, what kind of man would he have become? What kind of person would he have turned his life into? What would his children be like? What would his wife be like? What kind of business would he run? These are questions that I'll never have answers to. But I remember sitting in Western Wayne Correctional Center in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Not Western Wayne, sorry, Huron Valley Women's in Ypsilanti. Praying that this young man would turn his life around and he would get and have a better life. So I'm trying not to be bitter and angry. Because when I made that podcast in October, I was feeling a little angry, feeling a little bitter, feeling a little slighted. Because here it is, you're still committing crimes. You're still trying to hurt people, you know? And I know hurt people hurt people. And it was obvious that this 15-year-old was on the street at 11 o'clock at night with some other 15, 13, 15-year-olds with guns. There was some trauma, there was some hurt, there was some neglect, there was some stuff going on in their households. So when we say hurt people, we have to look at the trauma that so many of us have had and how we respond and how we react and the survival techniques that we have learned. So I'm torn because I can't be angry because I'm pretty sure this kid went through some stuff as a kid, but now he's a man. When does the wisdom kick in? When does the enlightenment kick in? What kind of children are you raising? They're the future. That's the next generation. They are the future. And as we see in our news stories all over the country, we had a lot of mass shootings. The majority of them are young white men shooting up venues and schools. But when they peel away the layers, these are hurt little kids who had they had no training around emotional intelligence, how to handle their anger, how not to suppress it, not to stuff it, but to feel it and work through it. How to handle their sadness and their fear, not to suppress it or ignore it, but to face it and work through it. We're not teaching our children to do this. I was not taught as a child to do this. Sadly, I didn't teach my children because I didn't know then. But I know now. So the other day, on my son's birthday, I had to sit here and work through it and think about why was this so sad for me? Yes, I lost my child. Yes, I lost a piece of my heart. And I was feeling so much pain that I couldn't even find the words to express or describe the pain that I feel. But I had to say that. I had to recognize that. I had to acknowledge that. I could have pretended that no, I wasn't feeling those things, and I could have ignored that my heart hurt so bad I couldn't explain it. But where's the victory in that? Where's the growth in that? We all, if we're human, and I'm pretty sure we all are spiritual beings living a human experience, have thoughts, feelings, emotions. It's a part of what, it's a part of our spirit, a part of our soul. It's there. And we all have. But we are not teaching our young people about those emotions and feelings that come up. and how to respond and how to move forward and how to carry that on to healing and growth. Last month or last broadcast, I read a letter from my oldest son who's incarcerated, and he was incarcerated at the time his brother was murdered. And the sad part about it is this young man, my son, Braymon is his name. His name is Braymon. Endured the pain of his mom's challenges with mental health, his biological father being incarcerated because he didn't know how to control his anger and his frustrations, and he committed a bunch of crimes. So he was in prison when Braymon was even born. And then the man that took on the responsibility of being Braymon's and Carlos' father. He was a good man, but he had a lot of pain. You know, and I didn't know about trauma and pain then. And he was self-medicating with drugs and alcohol and binges, you know, and that affected my behavior and how I reacted, and that affected my children because they were powerless and they watched what was going on. No, I wasn't using drugs and alcohol, but I was unstable to the point that I almost killed somebody and went to prison for it. And my son Braymon was in the house when it happened. The trauma of that. Less than 2 years later, his brother goes to prison because here's a kid that didn't know how to handle his emotions and his anger. And he harmed somebody, fatally harmed some people. We're not bad people. We weren't taught to be bad. We got big hearts. We love hard. But we didn't know how to handle the heartbreaks, the pain, the disappointment when people misuse us and take our kindness for our weakness. I didn't know how to handle that. And I hadn't taught my children how to handle that, sadly. So here's Braymon now without his mother, his father, his stepfather, his brother. And he's 13 years old. He has a grandfather that he barely knows. He has a grandmother that he barely knows, but they're willing to step up and take him. But he's got a lot going on and nobody to talk to. Nobody's listening to the pain that this child is having. Not even me, because I didn't know. So then we move on. A few years after that, his grandmother, my mother, passes away. That was the next closest person to him. He had a relationship with her. Not like his grandfather that was taking care of him, because that was my dad who had been in and out. He came on special occasions, you know, 2 or 3 times a year. But my mother was someone that he had been around all his life. Weekly, daily. Now she's gone. Then my brother moves to New York. And now he's really lost. At this time, he's about 19 years old. He's already struggling with his mental health. From all the trauma, from all the stuff that's locked up inside. So, between the age of 13 and 19, this child has lost every single person or every connection, every human connection that he trusted and felt safe with and had known all of his life, had been snatched away. So now he's on the street, kind of wandering around, having conversations with his brother and his mother, who aren't there. Because these were the people that he could talk to and he could trust with his heart, with his feelings. But they weren't there. So anyway, I had to reflect on those things on the 14th of July. Because I have so many questions that I'll never have answers to. So many mistakes, so many wrongs. That I don't have the chance to change or fix. With him, but maybe I can touch somebody. Maybe I can reach somebody. Because I talk about it, and I talk about the stigma of mental health. I work as a person who has been, that has experienced and have been diagnosed, and I have relevant issues, and I share what I do and how my life has become better because I stopped stuffing the feelings. I stopped reacting and I have learned how to respond and process through the thoughts, the feelings, and the behaviors. Yes, I fall short. Sometimes I slip. But I'm human. And I'm learning. Since I've been back in Detroit, I'm seeing layers and layers and layers of traumatized people who just was impacted with another major trauma of this COVID-19 pandemic that caused more isolation and more disconnect. You know, and I think the layer of young people that I'm seeing that are in their 20s and 30s and maybe even 40s are the generation of babies who were born during the crack epidemic of Detroit, Michigan. So there's a lot of trauma there because all they knew was survival by any means necessary. You know, whatever it took for me to survive, it's all about me. I also am dealing with and seeing some of us that were my age that got caught up in that drama. And sad to say, you know, we were already hurt children, some of us. And to get caught up into the escape of the drugs and the alcohol. And I still see so many of them caught up in it. And they're still using the drugs or alcohol. They're numbing. You know. And what getting caught up in our trauma looks like it looks like self-centeredness. When we get ourselves so lost in the responses, in the reactions, and the skills that we learned to survive the trauma, it becomes self-centeredness. Survival by any means necessary. It's all about me. We have not learned how to take responsibility for our actions. We have not learned not to be the victim, because all we want to do is blame others. We want to project our wrongs on somebody else. If you had not done that, then I wouldn't have done this. And I am justified in doing what I did because you did this or you did that. You know, just like this young man said, I can fuck up the bum. He's a bum. He's nobody. So I have the right to kill him. They pissed me off. They took my money. They did whatever they did, so I'm shooting their house up. And sometimes when these shootouts occur like that, innocent children die. They had nothing to do with what went on between two so-called adults, or three, or however many adults, you know, or somebody's grandmother, some elderly person, some innocent person sometimes dies. You know, these mass shootings, the shooting at in Buffalo, of all the black people. What was his reasoning for going in into a black neighborhood and shooting up the black grocery store, killing a bunch of people, men, women, old, young? What was his pain? And why did he feel he had to take his anger out? And he was right to do it. What told him that? A couple of days later, young kid goes into, first he shoots his grandmother. What? Okay. Why? Your grandmother? Really? What self-centered righteousness was going on in your head to tell you that whatever it was that she did or said, she deserved you killing her? Then you go into an elementary school and you kill a bunch of innocent children. And then I reflect on that. It's like, that's where his pain started. It started in an elementary school. It started somewhere where he was being bullied and teased and mistreated, and no one listened. No one protected him. No one gave him safety. Then you move forward again. And these are the ones that make the news. There's a website that you can go on. If you just type in mass shootings in America, there's a couple of criterias for mass shootings. Usually it's when two or more people are fatally shot. Or three or more people. It depends on who you're talking to. It depends on the who's clocking the statistics. But in most cases, it's three or more individuals that's been shot. So then you go on to the 4th of July parade. But I mean, literally in the United States, there's been over 250, maybe close to 300 now since the last time I looked, mass shootings in America. In America. Many of them are in the Bible Belt area. And mass shootings, another thing they can't decide on, if domestic violence, when you have a murder suicide, if that's going to be considered mass shootings or not. Some researchers do, some researchers don't. But we have a lot of those too, mass shootings, murder suicides, domestic, it's just mind-boggling of how dysregulated people are around emotional intelligence. Because no one's taught, somewhere along the line it got lost, and each generation is losing more and more and more of it, because nobody's teaching them. If I can't teach you something I don't know exists, if I don't know it, I can't teach it to mine. And if they don't know it, they can't teach it to theirs. What do we do? How do we turn this back? How do we turn this back? But anyway, fast forward. Then you got this mass shooting at a parade for the holiday, for the 4th of July. And by the way, I don't celebrate the 4th of July. Because when I look at the, they were celebrating their independence from another country.
Great. Got it.
How did you get your independence from that country? How many indigenous people did you murder to take this land so that you can have independence? How many black people were enslaved to help build this land so that you can have independence? I'm a black woman. My family comes out of Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, New Orleans. They were not free in 1776 on July 4th. They were slaves. So I don't celebrate this nation's independence. And that's a whole nother story, but we are losing our independence as we turn back, because I ain't even talked about Roe versus Wade and how that just got turned back. So what independence? Really? Anyway, back to the shooting. This was a very tragic shooting to shoot up this parade. But the one piece that sticks out to me is the 2-year-old child who lost both of his parents in that mass shooting. 2-year-old baby. Life has not even started. And he's already hit with major trauma. Major trauma, because what he knew, his security, his safe place, his safe people, I have already been ripped away from him, because somebody somewhere had some sort of issue and they wanted to blame everybody else because they were the victim, and it was everybody else's fault. And I'm angry and I'm pissed off, and you're gonna die for it. How crappy is that? I don't get it. I don't get it. I look at the suffering of the people. And I teach recovery. I've tried to practice recovery. And when I say recovery, I mean bringing my life back into a state of being, of wholeness, completion, mind, body, spirit, soul. Recovery is returning to a state of strength. Recovery is processing to regain, processing to have control of what's yours, who you are, where you're going, what's your purpose. In my journey, as I learned to start putting together the gems of my life of recovery. Recovery to me meant stability, mental and physical stability. Recovery meant to me accountability. Being able to be accountable for my actions, being able to be accountable for my feelings, being able to process and control. Those states of being. We use the word recovery a lot when it comes to substance use or treatments. You know, and basically it says I'm in recovery, so I'm receiving the treatment or I'm receiving. But no, that's the clinical definition of recovery. The actual definition in the dictionary, Oxford Languages, is a return to a state of normal, return to a normal state of health, mind, and strength. But then I question the word normal. What is normal? Everybody's normal is different. And for me, I don't want normal because that was there. That was not growth. That was just everyday routine. To me, I want to process through. And through the midst of my recovery, grow. I want growth. I want accountability. I want integrity. I want honesty. Those things, to me, is what recovery is. And when I find a safe place to talk, to share, to give, where there's listening without judgment, unconditional, then recovery can happen. But it takes a safe place. It takes a safe place. So recovery is a process. And hopefully we'll start to look at it as it's a process of change. It's a process of getting from where we were, unlearning unhelpful skills and learning new skills that helps us, that will direct us to our full potential as a human being. So I said all of this to talk about my journey this week and my process of processing the feelings and the emotions that I had around the murder of my child and the freedom of the murderer who keeps committing crimes and keeps being free, who has not learned the process or how to process and find recovery. He's still lost in his trauma and acting very self-centered in his actions. He's reacting. He's not responding in safety. So, as a powerful person walking in my journey, I will continue to share love, give love, speak love, and receive love. And my next episode, I think I'm going to share some stuff from my son, Carlo, and his thoughts around Roe versus Wade, my thoughts around Roe versus Wade, you know, and maybe do some more talk around relationships and recovery. So I want to thank you for joining me this morning. I want to thank you for tuning in. And remember, recovery starts when you find a safe place to open up, to share, to process thoughts, feelings, and emotions without judgment, without blame, without being victimized, without being gaslighted. So if you can, just be a listener. Ask yourself, why am I talking? Can I just listen? And as each one of us can do that, when someone is sharing their heart and their feelings and their hurts, people can grow. It's planting the seeds. So for now, I'm going to sign off. Love and light. Namaste. Blessings to each and every one.